Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 17th of April, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Charles Mallett. Welcome to the program, Charles.
Thanks, Mike.
And by video link, we've got Mark Anderson from Texas. So we're going to get started off with food production. And Charles, farmers have been finding it pretty difficult, as we all know, with the amount of rain at the moment. But of course, if it's clay soil, it becomes a big problem.
It absolutely does. And I think now the situation is such that with any soil, really, it's a problem. And this is something that's been happening for months now. October really was the beginning of very wet weather, which the government should have seen coming. So the question that presents itself is the government, and in particular DEFRA, leading us towards food shortages? We have news that a fund, sorry, just we'll go back to the first slide, reported by the NFU here that a farming recovery fund, DEFRA, lifts the 150-meter eligibility rule. That's their typo, not ours. Now, what this means is that in an attempt to support farmers who have been affected by flooding, DEFRA produced a scheme quite extraordinary in its premise, in that if you were further away than 150 metres from a watercourse, you were ineligible, despite the fact that you might still be flooded in exactly the same way. So the question is, should they have seen this coming or not? And we have here from the Department for Levelling Up the illustration of how much land is in agriculture, that green bar at the top, 63% of the overall land mass in England, that is. And further, they go on to talk about flooding and exactly how much of the UK's farmland is subject to flooding, being in National Flood Zone 3. 71% or thereabouts. So it seems perfectly extraordinary that DEFRA would not have had a plan in place. Now, we've talked a lot about the environmental land management schemes going back to January of this year, the announcement and then the recent counter-announcement that actually it was not going to be possible to fund what was set out originally. So we'll just have a quick look at what is available in the SFI, which was one that's been scaled back to only 25% of a holding. And to highlight the extraordinary efforts the government are going to pressure farmers into taking land out of food production, I've just pulled up an example here of hedgerows, which are, of course, critical for wildlife of all sorts. And the funding here is up to £3 per 100 metres or £10 per 100 metres to manage those hedgerows. And that's set against taking arable and horticultural land out of production, which has for flour mixes and bird food up to £732 per hectare. So it's an extraordinary disparity when, of course, hedgerows, according to the sort of the push for nature recovery, would be an ideal target, and yet that's something that the government have missed. So the next thing to look at is the sort of apparent sap by the government to put forward a statutory instrument about hedgerow regulations. Now, this might not be something that you consider to be particularly important, but the reason I draw your attention to it is because they're trying to make it look like they're producing tough regulations to ensure that nature is indeed protected. But of course, they say that these things may not happen except in the circumstances described. And of course, we then see, as usual, to enable the treatment of serious cause of harm to plant health or a serious infestation of any pest or weed. Well, considering the biosecurity environment at the moment, it's not hard to see how that might come to pass. And also the catch-all here we've got for the purposes of enhancing the environment or improving public or agricultural access. So really, the idea that hedgerows are to be improved and to become a sort of constituent part of the landscape seems to be based on thin air. And of course, we've got this theme again of access to the public and this idea of natural capital and indeed that possibly becoming a chargeable item. So what I'll do is just close up now with a look at where we are on the latest from the Agricultural and Horticultural Development Board, who have an updated report on wheat in particular, talking about the wheat crop looking poor and indeed the imports having gone up. So this is on the prices from the European Commission, forecasting that the prices will go up. The production's fallen and planting continues to be disrupted by heavy rain in top-producing regions. But I think the important bit there, the highlighted text at the bottom, is that sizable Russian wheat supplies continue to limit gains in wheat futures. So I return to my original question, which is the government and DEFRA setting us up for food shortages? Because, of course, the only reason that we are unable to access the wheat that might be produced by Russia, or indeed that will have a knock-on effect on our ability to secure crops that we're unable to grow here at the moment, is of course because of the government's refusal to sue for peace in Ukraine and indeed to impose sanctions. So they've put themselves into an almighty muddle. And of course, the taxpayer, you, are footing the bill to try and dig back out of this hole, as well as faced with the prospect of enormous increases in price and indeed a scarcity of food in the not too distant future. So that's really the update on what the government are calling food security at the moment.
But I don't think we can ignore, Charles, that in the meantime, while they're not bringing in Russian wheat, all this wheat is coming in from Ukraine, and it's extremely low quality, or it's corrupted, or it's poisoned in some way. And of course, this is the reason why Polish farmers in particular, but in fact, farmers right across the sort of former Russian eastern countries, Poland and north of Poland, campaigning against this. And so, you know, we're having this poor quality wheat dumped on the markets in the meantime.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's another critical part of it. And then, of course, the other thing, which I haven't discussed, but is there ever present, is the increase in input costs on the fertilizer side and the energy side. Again, you know, aligned with all of this, which again, the government are very much driving rather than it being a consequence of what would be natural market forces.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Well, let's move on to the issue of censorship. And I'm going to say thanks to Debbie for sending this over to me last night. This is the House of Commons Culture, Media and Sport Committee. Sixth report of session for 2023-2024, and it's called Trusted Voices. Now, of course, the issue of trust with respect to narratives is something that we've talked about quite a lot over the past period, because this is something which is absolutely at the forefront of the minds of those who are trying to keep control of a narrative that they have increasingly not got control of. But if we put that back on screen for a second, then let's just have a look and see what they say in this report. They say the pandemic has brought home just how vital it is to be able to access authoritative information. We highlighted in our 2020 report on misinformation, how online hoaxes and conspiracies had been allowed to spread across social media. However, the problem is not confined to COVID-19. And this is great, because what they then go on to do is tell us what the range of issues is. So climate change, 5G, water fluoridation, elections, and those claiming UK terror attacks have been staged. So everybody's doing very well. These people are extremely nervous about people campaigning on these issues. And so I would just say keep going, because it's getting them more and more rattled. Anyway, they go on in the report to say this makes it all the more important that there are prominent, trustworthy actors, or as they call them, trusted voices, who can provide evidenced, accurate information and communicate it in an accessible way. So I wonder who they might have in mind. Let's have a look and see. Given the government's role as a trusted voice during the pandemic, did you find the government to be a trusted voice during the pandemic? I should have prefaced this, by the way, as saying that this particular segment is going to be a comedy segment, so keep this in mind. But do you view the government as a trusted voice during the pandemic, Charles?
Not the word that springs to mind immediately, but I suppose trusted to be making it up from start to finish.
Yes. Okay. So if we put that back. As a trusted voice during the pandemic, we were concerned to hear about the shortcomings of its communications, with limitations with both the information transmitted and the methods by which it was done. We believe that the government could do more to utilize the vast number of experts and employees, building on the critical role played by the chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer during the pandemic to engage public issues of national concern. So, as I say, this is a comedy show. And of course, the Chuckle Brothers there, the chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer, lost the trust, shall we say, of the public very quickly, because because of their sheer incompetence. But anyway, we move on. During our inquiry, we received 53 pieces of written evidence. We held 6 oral evidence sessions where we heard from the founder of Money Saving Expert, Martin Lewis, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent, Mariana Spring, academics, fact checkers from Full Fact, and Channel 4 News. Now, of course, Channel 4 News is the organization that ran the pro-white helmets campaign in the UK. At least they took the lead on it. So I'm not sure I would consider them a trusted voice. Then others included the national newspapers, Sense About Science, the Science Media Centre, the National Academies, come on to that in a second, civil servants, and the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State at the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, Paul Scully, MP, and we'll come on to him in a second as well. Trust is fundamental, they say, to a well-functioning society. The extent to which people trust a person or an institution influences their opinions and their behaviour, and this is key. And they say that Alison Phillips, editor of the Daily Mirror, told them that she thought the trustworthiness of the established news organisations, Comedy Continues, had increased hugely compared to the mid-1980s, with content being far more informative, responsible and well thought through. And what we've got to say about this is, right the way through this, a complete lack of self-awareness, a complete lack of understanding of what people actually thought about the way that the pandemic was promoted in the mainstream press, about the fact that the game was up as soon as the SpyB documentation went out and people began to understand that the mainstream press had been used in order to push a narrative which would increase fear in the general public and to encourage behaviour change to get people to do what the trusted government wanted them to do. It's quite incredible that they had the gall to publish this in the way that they have, but let's go on with it. We heard from both independent and media organisation fact checkers during our inquiry and sought to understand how they can achieve and maintain a reputation as a trusted voice. Rebecca Skippage, disinformation editor, the editor of the disinformation that the BBC puts out, I would argue, but anyway, at the BBC, told us its fact-checking was underpinned by the BBC's twin pillars of impartiality and accuracy. It never ends. It's brilliant. The government's counter-disinformation unit leads the operational response to disinformation for the UK government and works with a range of partners, including other government departments, social media platforms, civil society groups, and academia. So just think about that. They are working with social media platforms. So if anybody's not understanding why they get shadow banned or they get material brought down, this offers the explanation. The Counter Disinformation Unit is working hand in glove with the social media platforms. Paul Scully, MP, we mentioned him already, said that the Counter Disinformation Unit was not some big shady intelligence unit. That's a lie. It's trying to find trends that it can say, this is happening, what do you want to do about it? I mean, there's so much documentation that demonstrates that that is simply false. But anyway, we are concerned about the lack of transparency and accountability of the Counter Disinformation Unit and the appropriateness of its reach. We recommend that the government commission and lay before Parliament an independent review of the activities and strategy of Counter Disinformation Unit within the next 12 months. So we will see whether that happens. I won't be holding my breath because I don't think the government has any intention or likely to do that at all. And of course, in the meantime, within the next 12 months, there probably will be a new government. So that isn't going to happen there either. Anyway, recommendations. We recommend that the government publishes advice for government departments and their public bodies on communication intended for young people, including guidance on the use of new apps and platforms, including TikTok. And it was a theme through this document that young people were extremely important, and the idea of capturing young minds was absolutely key. The government communication service should conduct and publish an evaluation of the effectiveness of government communications during the pandemic by the end of 2024, ensuring that this takes into account the views of the public and frontline organisations, such as those working with patients and carers. And the government should allow and encourage its scientists to respond directly to the media to counter misinformation. Okay. As part of the renewed focus on assessing the National Academies, the government should review what role the National Academies should play in the public information landscape and work with them to publish objectives and benchmarks to deliver on that role. And of course, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the Academy of Medical Sciences, the British Academy, the Royal Academy of Engineering and the Royal Society. Those are the main four. Those are the four national academies. There are also academies for Scotland and Wales, but those are the four national ones. But in the meantime, meantime, then, of course, yesterday in Brussels, the Nazi conference was taking place, the National Conservative Conference, and Suella Braverman heading that up. And, well, it was censored, or was it censored? But they certainly were making lots of noise about it being censored, because the Belgian authorities at the auspices of the mayor of Brussels decided to basically throw up a cordon and on the basis of public safety and so on. But this was the list of speakers, Suella Braverman leading it, Nigel Farage, Mateusz Morawiecki. Yes, I don't think we need to say very much. Viktor Orban was supposed to be speaking as well, and all of the other names that you'd see on screen. And as I say, the police decided that they would put up a cordon outside the place. But I just wanted to end this segment with a little bit of video from Suella Braverman, sorry. And well, we'll have a laugh about this at the end.
I'm here with like-minded Democrats, elected, democratically elected politicians, leaders and experts in their fields, and we are here talking about the issues that matter to the British people, but also many citizens around Europe, securing our borders, making our communities safer, and how to protect our countries. And it's a real shame that the thought police, instructed by the mayor of Brussels, also saw fit to try and undermine and denigrate what is free speech and free debate. I remember the words of Mrs. Thatcher, and I'm going to misquote her, but the more ridiculous and far-fetched and extremist their attempts are to silence us, the more cheered on I am, because it just shows that they've lost the political argument.
I mean, the hypocrisy of this woman is off the charts. This is the woman who, as Home Secretary, drove much of the censorship agenda in this country. And now she's on the receiving end of it herself, and she's busy making comments like that. I just find it absolutely incredible. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, more recently, of course, her treatment of the sort of demonstrations and gatherings in the name of freedom and peace from October of last year. Perfectly extraordinary. But yes, she does seem to encapsulate entirely what certainly a large percentage of the viewing audience of UK Column will be thinking, but just not quite meaning the same thing by it.
Indeed, yes. Okay, let's welcome Mark to the programme. And, well, World Health Day.
Yes, on April 9, good day, gentlemen, I covered virtually in real time the Chicago Council on Global Affairs program, World Health Day, Migration, Climate Change, and Global Health. And most of the photos you're seeing, pretty much all are original snapshots or screenshots from the program. And it was very interesting in that the approach seemed to be, and here's the speakers, Ibrahim Aboubakar, if I'm saying that right, the provost of the University College London, and the moderator was Maya Prabhu, and she's a clinical associate professor of law at Yale Law School. It was an interesting, if not kind of surreal, discussion, and it seemed to be weighted toward making climate change more personal, talking about things regarding climate change that would make us care more about the theory of anthropogenic climate change, that being the kind of climate change that's purely caused by mankind's industrial and leisure activities. Nothing to do with the sun and solar cycles and things like that. And there were many things discussed. I had to be really selective on what to present. Here in this next slide, one of the many things that was rolled out was Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, a species of coronavirus. This was cited during the program. And it showed, for instance, Time Magazine, which is notorious for having extremely fear-ridden covers for its cover stories. There was one I talked about years ago where it showed the earth on fire. This one just says, warning, we are not ready for the next pandemic. That's in 2017. Get the date on that time cover there. 2017, warning, we are not ready for the next pandemic. And other studies were cited, 2019, a world at risk, and something going all the way back to 2015. And moving on from there, just to sort of delineate what they rolled out at this program, we had climate migrants. So now the migration program, the border insecurity program, particularly at the southern border in the United States, that's being more strongly attributed to climate change. Not that weather couldn't have anything to do with it, of course. Crops do fail and people migrate. But you have to look at it in context. This slide, projected internal climate migrants by 2050, the World Bank's groundswell report projects that climate change could lead up to 216 million people across six world regions to move within their countries, not internationally so much, but within their countries by 2050, if we don't act. And let's move on from there. We can talk a little bit about groundswell. What is it? Well, here's some of the pages from a groundswell report that is about 362 pages in length. So I had to struggle to figure out what to include here, but it shows different regions around the world, the 216 million people. People can look at this in more detail, 40 million in South Asia, and so on and so forth. Going on from there, the slides, of course, will be in the show notes. The next one, taking action on internal climate migration, the number of people forced to move because of climate change could be reduced by as much as 80%. If we act now to cut global greenhouse gases and integrate climate migration, again, the thrust of the program was to make climate change more of a personal issue. Why should you care about it? Otherwise, it's just an abstraction. It's just computer models.
So, Mark, of course, the amount of migration would fall by 80% if there were 80% fewer people on the planet.
That'd be another way of looking at it. That's interesting. Moving on from there, I won't spend a lot of time on each particular slide. Again, I took all these with the screenshots as they did their program. If you've ever tried to take pictures of overhead presentations right at a live program, it never works out. This was much easier doing it virtually. Anyway, it says most migration is labor-driven. There's some truth to that. A lot of migration is south-south, 37%, mostly students and some refugees. It says here also that international migrants, they're saying, are highly heterogeneous, most very healthy. Now, that is highly disputable. At the southern border here in Texas, there were a lot of reports of TB and other communicable diseases coming through with the international migrants, which are coming over, of course, across the border between ports of entry in record numbers. So that's a very debatable claim during this program, April 9 in Chicago. And moving on from there, again, tugging at the heartstrings to get us more interested in climate change, UNICEF, children are being displaced by climate change. Millions of children are being driven from their homes by weather-related events exacerbated by climate change. So in other words, there are weather-related events that aren't necessarily tied to the climate change that they're talking about. So there's a lot of nuance there that you have to keep in mind. And in this next slide, the growing health toll of a changing climate, and this goes to the heart of heat-related labor capacity loss. In other words, as anthropogenic, so-called man-caused climate change, as that increases, there's going to be a loss of potential labor. Heat exposure led to the loss of 42% more hours of potential labor in 2022 compared to 1991 through 2000. The associated global potential loss of income reached $863 billion in 2022. So that ties climate change into labor loss and unrealized income, things like that. And people can look at these slides in more detail if they want to understand them to the nth degree. And here we have climate suitability for infectious disease transmission. The main speaker walked everybody through this. Climate change is altering the environmental distribution of food, water, air, and vector-borne infectious diseases, many of which threaten nutrient utilization. In 2022, a record 10% of the global coastline showed conditions suitable for Vibrio transmission. That's a type of bacteria often found in undercooked or uncooked seafood, and putting 1.4 billion people at risk and leading to a record 610,000 estimated vibriosis cases. And this again is just kind of what they walked everyone through. And then they got into their solutions, decreased the carbon footprint, of course, and going on from there, accelerate mitigation and adaptation, prioritizing energy, health, and food system interventions that can offer health co-benefits. And I think we're getting near the end of the slides, and I can comment a little bit on them. Local solutions in Sahel, which is just below the Sahara Desert, before you get into the tropical regions of Africa, that sort of in-between zone. Rising temperatures and decreasing rainfall, growing population, policymakers, academic partnership, so on and so forth. And frugal, locally developed adaptation, health system action, income diversification, water harnessing, farming innovation, planting trees, soil conservation. And some of that might do some good. It's not to say that all those actions are bad, but just looking at the context of this. And I'll note, Mike, that I did manage to get one of my questions answered. I've been raising my hand many times at WHO programs I've been covering virtually, and they never call on me. This time they did address one of my questions, and that was, does the speaker subscribe to the One Health view that animals, plants, and humans are to be all judged on the same level and giving the same value? And he said, that's easy to answer. The answer is absolutely yes. So that's how the main speaker summarized his comments, Mike. But the whole program, again, to kind of wind it up, was to give climate change a more human face and a more personable connection so people would care more. And the speaker completely dismissed any idea that anything other than anthropogenic climate change was the cause of so-called climate change. And of course, they trust the computer models completely. It's all a matter of faith, really, with this issue. So there you go.
Thanks, Mark. And I would make two points about that. First, the idea that heat exposure is causing a massive loss of labor. Well, how do we compare that? What happens when we compare that to the amount of labor that's been lost as a result of the vaccination policy and the number of people that are already in long-term sick, particularly in Western nations at the moment? And the other question about the distribution of food, bearing in mind what Charles kicked the program off with today, that's just laughable as well. Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, we have a page you can go to find out how you can support us at support.ukcolumn.org. And all the options are there. If you can possibly help us out, we do need your support, and it is only your support that keeps us going. So that's much appreciated if you can. UKcolumn.org and UK Column Extracts are the main places to go, but you could share anything that you find on all the various platforms. And please do have a look at the items that are available on the UK Column shop. Now, Brian has another episode of Walking the Dog happening on Sunday, 11 a.m. on his YouTube channel. The link to that will be in the show notes on the UK Column website. So do listen to that if you possibly can. Tomorrow, we have an interview with Nicola Lund, who is was a school teacher and, during lockdown and COVID and so on, ended up moving careers into journalism. And so she's talking about that transition. If you'd like to join us at 1 p.m. for that tomorrow. Another reminder that on Monday next week, Playing God, the documentary from Jackie Devoy, will be premiering on the UK Column website at 2 p.m. on Monday, immediately following the UK Column news. So join us for that if you possibly can. Then yesterday's interview with Dr. Charles Hoffa is the on-demand version of that will be on the website shortly after the news today. So if you haven't seen that already, please have a look, share it. And if you can possibly help Charles Hoffa's crowdfunder for his legal expenses, that would be great as well. A reminder of the Sounds Beautiful Festival taking place in Wimborne and Dorset, June 27th to the 30th. We had the guys on from that on Extra last Wednesday. If you haven't seen that, have a look, but hopefully you can make it there. There is a promo code for 10% off. And Darren from The Light will be joining us in Extra today to talk about the Stand in the Light Festival taking place in May 24th to the 27th. Various UK Column people will be at both these events. So if you can possibly come along and say hello, that would be fantastic. Okay, where does that take us then? That takes us to geoengineering. Charles?
Yes, indeed.
Fornethy. Sorry, I do apologise. We have to mention this. Fornethy House Survivors petition is going to be heard in Holyrood, and that's happening today, I believe. And so have a look at this Glasgow Times article for a bit more information on that. But mainly the point here is to say a massive thank you to everybody that helped with their crowdfunder, because on Monday's programme that was sitting at around £200 or £300 is now £2,500. And I'm just going to say that is a fantastic response, and thank you very much to everybody for that. So finally, let's move on to geoengineering.
This follows the increasing steps that this subject is taking into the public domain. I reported on this back in November after the COP28 meeting, where the wider topic of geoengineering was discussed. And before we go into the specific detail, I'd like you to consider the precautionary principle, which, when applied to scientific study, is really the basis by which an activity does or does not go ahead, in that if there's a perceived risk and an unknown, then the activity does not go ahead. So with that in mind, we will have a look at the University of Washington's Marine Cloud Brightening Program. You may have heard of this, which would not be their intent, because the news surrounding it has been that they have done this very quietly, but of course it has actually attracted a significant amount of attention. So what we'll do now is we'll just have a look at an American news video reporting on exactly what's happening and why, and then we'll come back into the studio for comment and analysis.
That roar is not coming from a snow machine. Instead, the plume you see are tiny aerosol particles. It's the first technology in the country to test ways to brighten clouds in an effort to cool the globe.
This system, it's composed of three main components.
In these tanks, Jessica Medrado and a group of scientists from the University of Washington's Marine Cloud Brightening Program are mixing salt and water and using a compression system to test if this machine can distribute the right size particles. They say Alameda provides the perfect cloud conditions over the bay.
If you make the particles that are too small, they are not going to create the effect that you want in this marine cloud. If you make them too big, they will actually create or induce rainy clouds.
The goal? To mimic the effects of pollution in a cleaner way, using salt water to brighten clouds, which they hope will then reflect more sunlight back into space to help cool the Earth. Still in the early phases, program director Sarah Doherty says right now they need to figure out if it's even possible and how much impact it could have.
To understand, so with something like marine cloud brightening, you're not going to just reverse global warming. So it's really important how it plays out in the climate system will depend on where you could brighten clouds and how much.
Cal State East Bay professor Elena Giventel is excited about the research, but cautions that as Earth continues to heat up, the various ideas for cooling the world are not without controversy.
While there are certain benefits from trying to cool the environment, We're not quite sure what kind of negative effects.
Doherty believes reducing emissions is the most important tool, but says that alone won't be enough.
But we are kind of locked in at this point, committed to significant climate disruption. So the question is, are there other things we can do to help reduce suffering and impacts? And this might be one of them.
The group of researchers plan to be here throughout the summer. They also hope that they can make this an educational experience for those who visit the museum. In Alameda, Valina Jones, NBC Bay Area News.
What does she mean by committed to significant climate disruption?
Well, exactly. One of a number of questions that falls out of that, and I would defy anybody to watch it and consider that what they're doing seems in any way sensible. But this follows Mark's segment neatly in that this is predicated on the belief that the vast majority of people will view such a thing as entirely necessary because of the supposition that anthropogenic climate change is actually a thing. And so we're going to look, rather than go back and analyse the specific video, although I would encourage you to watch it again and share it widely because of the number of questions that it leaves begging. But we're going to look at what the University of Washington says about what it is doing and why. So they're calling this marine cloud brightening. And as you heard, it reduces climate warming by intentionally increasing the reflection of sunlight from marine clouds. So this is the theory. So in effect, to mimic pollution, which sounds completely extraordinary and is completely extraordinary. An overarching goal of the research is to provide open, objective, scientific information to address near-term climate risk. So we're sowing the seeds of panic, but it's the open and objective claim that we want to come back to. But obviously the critical part of this slide here is the fact that they are not certain. So I refer back to the precautionary principle. They have absolutely no idea what the effect will actually be. And you can see there the enormous spread of talking about as little as 0.2 of a degree Celsius or as much as 1 degree. Well, there's an enormous disparity between those two figures in relative terms. So it just highlights that despite the inconsistencies, they're still going to go ahead with it. And they talk about the stakeholder engagement efforts. And again, what I particularly want to talk about or look at is the engagement, sort of further down, engagement with the Global South and Indigenous peoples on field science. So in effect, the suggestion that the Global South has no idea about the sort of thing, and this is potentially an area in which, let's say, indoctrination perhaps can be pursued. Relevant to the United Kingdom audience, the program here in the team is led by Robert Wood and Sarah Doherty at the University of Washington. But it goes on to say the program also collaborates with researchers at a range of other institutions, including the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. I got in touch with the University of Exeter to ask them a range of questions about the involvement of the particular scientists and what other weather modification programs they might be involved in. And their response was brief. They said, no University of Exeter scientists are part of or funded by the University of Washington's Marine Cloud Brightening Program. Exeter researchers collaborate with University of Washington researchers providing expertise in climate modeling. Well, that seems a slightly disingenuous reply because the statement from Washington suggests that they are, in fact, a part of it, even if it is in a collaborative context. So there is a little bit of hair splitting going on there. But the point of it is that they are providing modelling. Now, which way is modelling going to go? And is this research actually open and objective? They spoke about being funded by an organisation called Silver Lining. And so let's have a look at Silver Lining, ensuring a safe climate. And within their policy document, they say that the international community currently lacks the critical scientific information needed to make informed decisions. So you could interpret that as saying that that's why such research needs to go ahead in order to find out this information. Or more realistically, perhaps, you could suggest that that means that this research should not be going ahead. And again, with reference back to the precautionary principle, again, another reference to the Global South, suggesting that that the lack of access to research and funding means that they need to be brought into this for the purposes of equity, of course. Now, this is a topic that has sort of enthused organisations across the board. University of Cambridge, this is looking back to last year when they went to COP28, and they, you know, expressly state that these are just ideas. There are various ideas for refreezing the Arctic, including marine cloud brightening, stratospheric aerosol injection, and even pumping of seawater onto the top of sea ice. So we'll come back to that because that is absolutely relevant to what's going on now. The Royal Society have been talking about this since 2009, but they had a bilateral workshop with Norway last year. And in that, they talked about the research, the sort of status of research at the moment. And they really just give a good idea of the enormous numbers of bodies that are researching exactly this. So again, we've got the marine cloud brightening and stratospheric aerosol injection. But the important thing is that a common argument against this is that research itself will increase the likelihood of implementation, but in fact, research will often rather reveal new undesirable side effects associated with implementation of solar radiation management, and thus could equally well provide discouragement for it. So the same could be said to apply to marine cloud brightening. And again, they go on with the reference to the international law, and they talk about the potential to reduce the rate of warming and all this sort of thing. But there are therefore concerns that solar geoengineering could produce regional shifts in hydrological conditions that would be greater or more harmful than those expected under climate change. So with all this in mind, how on earth has it been permitted to have gone ahead, apparently without any consent or consultation of the residents around the Alameda Bay area where the USS Hornet is at anchor? So finally, just to highlight the sort of absurdity of the situation, I just want to look at the British Antarctic Survey from September 2023, where they state that clouds formed with sea salt contribute to Arctic warming. Now, I'm not comparing like for like here, because obviously we're in a much colder area, but nonetheless, the fact that in the British Antarctic Survey have been doing more or less the same thing, and they say the high concentration of sea salt aerosols has been shown to increase cloud droplet concentration and the amount of solar radiation reflected back towards the Earth. So in effect, the British Antarctic Survey here concluding that what they're doing in the United States at the minute has had the exact opposite effect.
Mm. Okay, let's move on to warfare. And well, You spoke about Dragonfire some weeks ago, Charles. You introduced it to our audience. And of course, this is the missile defense system, which is basically a directed energy weapon. Dragonfire, they've announced, is now going to be installed on multiple Royal Naval warships from 2027. Now, they're very excited about this because they're saying this is as the result of a reformed procurement system, which means that they could get it onto these warships a lot faster than otherwise. So we have a little bit of video which features the wonderful Grant Shapps. So let's just have a look at that.
That roar is not...
That's the wrong one, Stephanie. Grant Shapps. Yeah, that's it.
This is Dragonfire, the UK's first laser weapon. Able to shoot down drones and missiles with incredible accuracy, it could revolutionise how we fight wars. And this isn't an idea decades away, we're building it right now to fit onto our warships in just 3 years' time. Rapid delivery of this incredible feat of British innovation is only possible because the government has this week reformed the way we procure for our military. So, we'll be faster in getting our weapons into the hands of our soldiers, sailors and aviators years ahead of schedule. And through these reforms, we'll build more lethal British armed forces to defend the United Kingdom from threats at home and abroad.
Did that inspire you?
Probably not the way that you would have intended.
No. So basically, they're reforming things by sort of removing the hurdles to just getting on and doing it. So we'll have more on this soon. But in the meantime, of course, Britain continues to be committed to European security. They should be committed, but I'm not sure to any form of European security. But anyway, this is a meeting that was taking place this week in Sofia. And of course, a more effort to get stuff over to Ukraine, and UK very happy to have reminded everybody this week, because these two minesweepers, which used to be part of the Royal Navy, I mean, the Royal Navy doesn't really have any ships left, but we're now giving them away to Ukraine. Well, why? Because the Ukraine is the dumping ground for everything. So it doesn't matter whether it's a car that can no longer be driven in London because of ULEZ, or a minesweeper that we is probably too expensive to scrap. So we just send it off to them instead. It's a great deal. But in the meantime, the BBC is very keen to tell us that Russia has now had 50,000 people killed in the course of the conflict. This is confirmed as far as the BBC is concerned. What amuses me about this, it's not amusing that anybody has died, but just I'm talking about the BBC's coverage of this whole situation. They refuse to confirm any kind of statistics on Ukrainian dead because there might be an extra zero on the end of that number. In that case, But the BBC totally silent on the issue of Ukrainian dead. They're happy to publish graphs and stuff like this to try to tell us how bad Russia is doing, but no comment on Ukraine. So what is the latest on Ukraine?
Well, indeed, although I'm minded of accuracy and impartiality when looking at those graphs, which, of course, is disturbing. But yes, the latest is that Ukraine, having been somewhat relegated to the back seat now that Iran has come into the fore, Zelensky nonetheless is still banging the drum for engagement with other countries, the United Kingdom in particular, but also others. And he's announced on his website, President of Ukraine, that he's requesting a meeting of Ukraine NATO Council, and he's making an address. So this, of course, relates back to the speech that David Cameron made that we reported on last week. In particular, what I would like to draw your attention to is Zelensky talking about discussing protection of the skies, supply of anti-aircraft warfare systems and missiles, but also a first global peace summit in June. So we'll be interested to see how exactly that turns out and what indeed the United Kingdom and the United States will have to say about it. But with David Cameron in mind and what he was saying about China last week and the week before, it's interesting how the waters can be muddied, particularly with regard to Ukraine, because, of course, he's talking about the German chancellor, but also he refers to the signals they've heard from Beijing and says China can really help us restore the just peace for Ukraine and the stability in international relations. So how will that be regarded by the UK? Will it effectively queer the pitch? But he brings in the topic of restoring the just peace. And on the theme of restoration and all the rest of it, I want to look at the Attorney General, who's come out as the sort of latest cheerleader for Ukraine. She's pledged to support Ukraine in their efforts, having just spoken, well, not just, but a week or so ago at The Hague. And also that we look further back, there she is with Zelensky in February, marking the two-year anniversary of the Ukraine conflict. Also, she's come out and spoken back in September last year, talking about the case against Russia at the International Court of Justice, which was essentially about the suggestion of genocide by Ukraine. And she said in the hearing today, the UK made submissions regarding the scope of the court's jurisdiction under the Genocide Convention, including concerning the requirement of good faith and the fact that the Genocide Convention does not in any circumstances authorise states to commit aggression, war crimes or crimes against humanity. Of course, there's a deafening silence where Israel and Gaza are concerned from the Attorney General. So really just an identification of the hypocrisy, but also the partisanship there when it concerns Ukraine. But on the theme of restoration and reconstruction, it's now becoming a sort of hotter topic. It started up last year, but here we've got the European Commission talking about co-hosting an international conference, which is the one I've just referred to that Victoria Prentice spoke at. And then we've got the Council of Europe talking about the register of damage for Ukraine. And of course, this is the important part because this is where we begin to look at all the enormous amounts of money which are swilling around outside of the defence contributions. And here from the Department of Business and Trade, updated a few weeks ago in March, incentives or initiatives to support UK businesses who are helping to rebuild critical infrastructure in Ukraine, or possibly what one might refer to as profiteering. Figures published by the World Bank outline that reconstruction costs are expected to amount to $486 billion over the next decade. And the Department of Business and Trade is encouraging innovative UK businesses to contribute their experience and expertise in rebuilding Ukraine's damaged infrastructure. So what sort of shape is this likely to take? And although outside of the United Kingdom's sphere of influence, I think it's relevant to look at one of the contracts that's already in motion, which is by VEON, the communications company. VEON and Kyivstar set in motion their $600 million US dollar investment plan. And there's Mike Pompeo joining the delegation. So again, plenty of external influence. And of course, just to get a flavour of what VEON are all about, we look back to 2021, where they're rolling out the new industry standard for digital identity validation, in which they say that their chief executive talking about it being one of the great challenges of our time, and that the world has struggled with the competing forces of want to make the consumer experience more seamless while decreasing the risk of online fraud. So the point really is that this sort of apparent desire to build back better, of course, will have very, very serious consequences for the people of Ukraine, for whom the future will be utterly, completely different due to this reconstruction effort.
Yes. Okay, Mark, we've just done a little bit of editing of the order here, and let's have a look at the latest update on the World Health Organization and the pandemic treaty.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, very recently in the Federal Register, that compilation of regulations and public comment periods in the U.S. government, the Office of Global Affairs, I'm showing here, of the Department of Health and Human Services, is putting a notice of public listening session out again, a request for comments. This is another opportunity for people, not just in the U.S., according to the noted WHO watchdog James Roguski, but also people in the U.K. and throughout the world can comment. And the listening session will be held Thursday, May 2nd, 2024, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time U.S. This session is open to the public, but requires an RSVP to that website that, or excuse me, email I've given before, oga.rsvp. Well, this has the number one in it, oga.rsvp1@hhs.gov. Listeners can see this in the show notes, and do that by Friday, April 26th, RSVP by that time, April 26th, in order to take part in that May 2nd listening session. Very important. The session will be held virtually, online, and dial-in information will be shared with those who register. The purpose of it, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services leads the U.S. delegation to the 77th World Health Assembly and will convene this informal stakeholder listening session. The session is designed to seek input from stakeholders. I love that word, don't you? Stakeholders. What about citizens? And subject matter experts. Experts in subject matter to help the HHS Office of Global Affairs inform and prepare for the U.S. government engagement at the World Health Assembly. Of course, that's coming up May 27th through June 1st, when they anticipate they're going to finalize the World Pandemic Treaty, something to be very concerned about in its outcomes. Moving on from there, the matters to be discussed at the 77th World Health Assembly, there's a link there that viewers and listeners can click on, but I give some highlights. Pillar number one, 1 billion more people benefiting from universal health coverage, acceleration toward the UN Sustainable Development Goals regarding maternal health and child mortality in particular. Child mortality is very interesting for the WHO, since it also supports abortion on demand and the entire abortion industry through what's called reproductive health care. Without hesitation, the UN and the WHO as a branch of the UN supports the abortion industry. So child mortality, very interesting there. Antimicrobial resistance, accelerating national and global responses. Going on from there, pillar number two, in the next slide, just some highlights. The implementation of the international health regulations that stem back to 05 and ultimately to 1969. The working group on amendments to the international health regs, that's involved in pillar number two. The intergovernmental negotiating body to draft and negotiate the WHO convention, agreement, or other international instrument on pandemic preparedness and prevention and response. Again, they hesitate to call it a treaty, even though they sometimes do, because that's what it is. And I believe we have pillar number three, just a couple matters. Well-being and health promotion, but notice the last one, climate change and health. So there, that concept comes up once again. So this is how people can get involved. This is the new time frame. I believe I have another slide or two. This is some information I carried over from my last report. I won't recite much of it except to say that viewers and listeners can access this through the show notes, and you can access the EU Parliament. It has a liaison office in London at 32 Smith Square. The EU Parliament liaison office in Dublin, Ireland is at 12-14 Lower Mount Street. And I give the phone numbers and emails for those that want to contact their members of the European Parliament. Of course, parliament.uk. You can easily scroll down and contact House of Commons and House of Lords members. And in the U.S., it's important to note that the Senate Bill 444 by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, guys, that piece of legislation, which has been dormant for over a year, and I called Johnson's office yesterday to find out why, and I still not have gotten a response back. I'm still waiting for a response. But that legislation, SB 444, defines the WHO Pact as a treaty to force the U.S. Senate to treat it as such and give their constitutionally required advice and consent on that. So a lot of moving parts here, but this is a critical time. And today is the last day of the current stakeholder session where you can still contact the Office of Global Affairs of HHS. And the one I talked about just a minute ago was the next upcoming one. So this is the tail end of the current one. And now we're going into the upcoming public input session. So a lot to unravel, but very important and timely information, guys.
Yeah, and Mark, what is going to happen by the end of May then?
Well, they expect to consummate the treaty May 27th through June 1st at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, Switzerland. I was hoping to get Scott Tipps there. I'm still kind of working on that. Maybe he could be a liaison for us. But it's hard to say exactly. If you look at James Roguski's research at jamesroguski.substack.com, there's been a lot of delays, and they've broken some of their own rules on giving the member states, Mike, giving the member states enough time to review the regulation amendments, the amendments to the international health regs, and the elements of the pandemic treaty. So they're trying to run, they're not giving the member nations enough time to review it. So it is possible, Roguski believes, that they'll botch this and they'll have to delay the finalization of the treaty to another time. But they really want it. They're salivating at this. So they're going to try.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, what kind of pressure are congressmen and women coming under about it?
Well, it seems like it's too quiet. Like they're not looking at SB 444. Why has that bill been dormant for over a year? When initially Ron Johnson brought it out, he was very enthusiastic. This is a treaty. The Senate's got a big job here. There's a lot going on. And now it's just been quite silent, actually, Mike, as far as I can tell so far.
Yeah, I think that's the feeling I get in the UK as well. I think I'd like to see a lot more pressure coming onto MPs at this point. Okay, let's move on then, and police and the question of police discipline. So this is all about sacking rogue officers, and so the government has decided that they, through secondary legislation, the statutory instrument laid before Parliament, to make it easier for chief constables to sack rogue officers during misconduct hearings, is what they're saying. So in other words, chief constables are going to be given the responsibility for chairing the hearings, which will decide on the removal of officers found guilty of police misconduct. Police leaders, in inverted commas, will be held increasingly accountable for their own officers. So what this also means is that police and crime commissioners, who, as we all know, are democratically elected, so that's okay then, are going to have to take a larger role in this process and providing oversight for the decisions that the chief constable makes. The government statement, however, said this: the Home Office has also committed to providing funding to develop an automated and continuous integrity screening system of the police workforce to ensure that officers are continuously vetted throughout their careers. I don't know, Charles, what you think about this. You're a former police officer yourself. What do you think about the disciplinary procedure for police and putting that in the hands of chief constables? Because it seems to me that if the police have been receiving a lot of bad press in the last couple of years because of sexual offences and so on from police officers and the police being perceived as not having dealt with it, then putting a chief constable in charge of the board that makes these decisions gives the police much more scope for cover-up.
Yeah, it would seem to, and I think that's exactly the point. Particularly referring to leadership, there's a fault. Clearly identified fault up and down the chain, which His Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary has identified in multiple reports. So have others. And to suggest that removing one possible check and balance would help is absolutely ridiculous, as is the suggestion that chief constables until now have in effect had their hands tied behind their backs. They absolutely haven't. And so it is absolutely a mechanism by which an awful lot more could be hidden. But also then in terms of the continual vetting, I mean, that again is a bad precedent, I would say.
Well, I would say it's going to end up being attached to AI at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
And yes. Okay. Well, that's it for today. We'll have to leave it there for now. So I'm going to say thank you very much to everybody that's joined us today. And we'll be back in a few minutes for some UK Column News Extra. And Mark and Charles will be there, and also Darren from The Light. So do join us for that in a few minutes if you're a UK Column member. Otherwise, we'll see you on Friday at 1 p.m. as usual. Don't forget the interview at 1 p.m. tomorrow. See you Friday.